what you want to say is more important, and practice makes perfect, not the perfect makes practice.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, admonish to draw near.
Welcome to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, the legal English podcast for non-native English speakers to help you improve your English listening, improve your legal English vocabulary, and build your knowledge of American legal culture. Hi, this is Daniel, and before we begin today's episode, I want to remind you that U.S. Law Essentials offers online courses in legal English and U.S. law. Our courses are designed for international attorneys, law students, and translators. If you have any questions, please contact Daniel at daniel@uslawessentials.com and join us on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And now, today's episode.
Welcome to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Horowitz. And today, we continue our series of interviews on the topic of multilingual lawyers with our special guest, Songryol Ryan Park, who works for the government of the Republic of Korea as a director in the Ministry of Unification. Welcome, Ryan.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Stephen. Good to see you
again. Yeah. Good to see you too. And I like the background on your screen. I know our listeners can't see it, but it looks like a giant mountain or volcano.
Yeah, it's a kind of volcano, but it's suspended its activity. But it's a called Mountain Baekdu. It's kind of some symbolic, iconic mountain for the Korean people, not only for the South Korean, but also to the whole North and South Korean. It is at the border of the China and the North Korea, and the highest mountain in Korean Peninsula. It's a kind of some spiritual meaning or symbolic meaning to Korean people.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about that. That's really neat. But if I ever visit South Korea, I won't be able to visit it because it's North Korea?
Yes, you have. Even the South Koreans visit the mountain through the China because you can visit North Korea. Uh-huh.
Okay, so if we go to China, we can then go up one side of the volcano. That's really interesting. It looks pretty stunning.
Yes.
So I first met Ryan while he was an LLM student at Georgetown Law, and he took my Georgetown online legal English course in the middle of the pandemic. But I didn't meet him in person until a year or so later when my colleague, Professor Michelle Ueland, organized a visit to the Library of Congress, which is right near the law school campus, and Ryan and I both joined on the tour. And that was the first time we got to meet in person. On that tour, we were fortunate to have a presentation from the Library of Congress Foreign Law Research Department. And at the end of the presentation, I remember the presenter saying something about if LLM students are ever interested in working there, you know, they feel free to speak with him. And Ryan, I remember you spoke with a representative right then, and that, I think, led to what you've been doing the last 6 months or so, which is working for the Foreign Law Research Department at the Library of Congress before you return back to Korea in late January. Is that right?
Yes, actually, that was the last April field trip by the Georgetown Law. And even though I graduated in the February, thanks to Professor Ueland, she invited me. And yeah, Stephen and I was at the Library of Congress. And at the time, I was the visiting fellow at the Surrey North in STEAM Center. So they asked me, as soon as my contract as a visiting fellow to STEAM Center expired, let's work together. So I began working the Library of Congress at the end of November.
So it's recently.
Yeah. So just next day after my visiting fellow contract expired.
And how has it been working at the Library of Congress? What kind of work have you been doing?
Yeah, I was astonished by the atmosphere of the world largest or world biggest library. And they are not just a U.S. library, but some kind of world library. So they have the many South Korea materials and even the North Korea materials, and quite old one and quite recent one both. So my main job is to update their online legal research guide for the each country. So I take in charge of the update the online research guide to North Korea, and some partial updates to that page of the South Korea, and to help them to assist them the library to supplement their collection of the North Korean legal materials, and some kind of research assistant job, whichever topic the director or some congressman is curious about the North Korea or South Korea.
Oh, do you get legal questions from Congress about North Korea or South Korea?
I'm not sure whether specific congressman asked for, but my director, the Ms. Umeda Sayuri, the foreign law specialist, who is in charge of the China, Japan, Korea section, she asked me and requested me to research about something and write about some article about some topic.
And I wonder how do they get North Korean legal materials? Is it online, or do they have to get copies of books? Does it have to get smuggled out of the country?
No. Both of them. So there are many online materials for the North Korean articles or legal materials, not only by some private publishers, but also the North Korean authorities, North Korean government itself release some their constitution or some criminal code, not only in Korean, but also in English. They released in many ways.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And some other materials are only in printed versions. So the library contact vendors and acquired it with payment. But after COVID-19, there is a closure between the North Korea and outer world, especially the Chinese border and Russian border. So nowadays, there will be difficulties to get some of that kind of printed version.
And let me ask you a language question. Are there differences in the Korean language from North Korea and South Korea that you notice in reviewing research materials?
Actually, more than 99%. We don't need any translator or interpreter when we work with North Koreans or we research in North Korean documents or materials. But some terminology have a different meaning, or in the same meaning, they have different terminology. For example, the squid have in Korean pronunciation or in Korean terminology, we call it ojingeo. Uh-huh. It means a squid, but in North Korea, it means octopus.
Oh,
so the same alphabet, same pronunciation, but different meaning. So that is the kind of the result of the more than 70 years of dividend. And second sector, due to the ideological differences, there are some new terminology that is not exist in South Korea. Yeah.
Can you think of an example of some terminology that might be in North Korean?
The one example is that they prefer to use very native Korean terminology. Usually in South Korea, we use many of the foreign languages and just make it change it to the Korean word as it pronunciated, like the birthday party. Sometimes we use it as a birthday party, as it is pronunciated. We just write down in Korean, not in English, but the pronunciation is the same. But in North Korea, because they don't like US, they try to change all the pronunciation or alphabet to some native Korean meanings. So the cellular phone, we use the Korean some cell phone or handphone or that kind of English-like pronunciation. But in North Korea, they call it 손전화. It means, 손 means hand, and 전화 means telephone.
So they use a more literal translation. I just heard a story about that from a lawyer, a French English speaking lawyer from Montreal, who talked about how in France they might just say a hot dog and use the English term, but in Quebec, where they're more sensitive about their use of French and want to hold on to it, they'll use an actual French word for a hot dog. So it sounds somewhat similar to that.
Yeah, but when I work with North Korea authorities, yeah, we never use an interpreter or translator, so we can communicate in linguistic manner, but in some business manner or some philosophy manner, we have to check what the terminology means to each side. Yeah, but the portion is very small. Almost all the terminology we can understand each other.
So it's not a language, it's more of a cultural, a politically philosophical difference.
Yes.
Speaking of which, I just saw yesterday on the Language Log blog, which is a blog by a linguistics professor, there's a post called Mind Your P's and Q's, and it's all about North Korea cracking down on people giving their children names that don't end with a hard consonant sound. Had you heard about this?
I'm not sure about that, but for example, North Korean normal, ordinary people cannot make a name of their babies the same name to the dictators, the ruling family's name, like the Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un. So the kind of name cannot be exist in North Korea, except the exact the family, ruling family.
Okay. Well, this is more about the last sound in the name, and it says that there's been influence from South Korea. More people have names that end in a vowel, like or e, and that the North Korean government is not so happy with that, and they want more names that end with like a p or a k kind of sound. Or a book, I guess.
It means because in Korean alphabet, we have the sort of Chosong, Chungsong, Chungsong. It means the first vowel, second vowel, the third vowel. So my name, Songnyeol, have the top and the bottom also. And you mean that in South Korea, some names pronunciated like Western name, like the Sua or Luke or something. But the traditional Korean names have the bottom vowel or bottom one, like the Kim Hyuk. Songnyeol was the kind of sound. So I think North Korean authorities do not want to make their people have some Western kind of name.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting. So can you tell me a little more about the work that you've done with the Ministry of Unification? Because I think North Korea is an area of the world that most people know very little about, and yet it's something that's a very big part of the work that you've been doing over the last number of years.
Yeah. The Ministry of Unification is the central government office in South Korea, which is in charge of the many affairs dealing with North Korea. So it is very unique organization worldwide, because there are many some finance, treasury ministries in every countries, but the Ministry of Unification may be only us. And yeah, there were the kind of government agency in Germany, but before the unification, East West Germany era. So our main job have three pillars. So first one is dealing with North Korea. So negotiation, inter-Korean trade, or some investment, or humanitarian aid, and so some etc. And second pillar is the cooperate with the international communities. So that job is mainly in the cooperation with our Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So the North Korean nuclear or denuclearization affair is quietly international matters these days. So, and the third pillar is the some kind of domestical issues. So many North Korean defectors came from China or through Thailand or through Mongolia to South Korea. Their number is outnumbered the soldiers of the Marine Corps in South Korea. So they are now more than 35,000 people. And constitutionally, they are Korean people as they are born. So my Ministry of Unification do our best to have them to settle down in South Korea well. And some many we do in domestically, we do some kind of unification education to let people know why we are divided, why we have to do unification or something like that. Yeah.
And how frequently in your career are you actually meeting face to face with government representatives from North Korea, or how much of this is by email or by written letter or other forms of communication or Zoom chats?
For me, for my 15 years of career, more than half of my work experience is inter-Korean exchanging cooperation. And I cannot say in detail because of some secret issue, but yeah, I did quite a lot, but not a Zoom chat, mostly in person or by fax or some documents. Yeah, delivery by some agent or something.
Oh, that itself must be an extra layer that makes communication a little bit more challenging and require more expertise.
Yeah.
And when you were growing up and thinking about what you would do in the future, were, you know, as a teenager or a college student, were you thinking about working on issues related to unification, or is this something that you, a direction you went in later in your career?
Frankly speaking, I did not know much about these issues till I graduated high school. As you know, more than half of the South Korean population live in the Seoul, capital city or Seoul greater Seoul metropolitan area, which is in the range of the North Korean long-range artillery. So the status quo of the half of the Korean is under the threat of the North Korea people. So we have to think about it. But specifically, I began to dreaming about working on this field at when I was a freshman in university, because when my first semester ends, maybe in my final term exam period, there was a first in history of Korea, there was a first inter-Korean summit between President Kim Dae-jung and Chairman Kim Jong-il at 2000. So that intrigues many of my friends, including me, think about the unification and inter-Korean issues, and that might be in our future as a grown-up, as a worker, there might be many sectors in detail to work in, very like a vocation or some interesting. Anyway, there are many things to work in our 30s or 40s. So many of my friends, including me, devote our lives to the kind of sectors.
It seems like something that would, as a citizen of Korea, you can easily feel a very strong commitment to it, and it has a very direct impact on not just your life, but the life of everybody you know in Korea.
Yeah.
Now, you graduated from Georgetown Law with an LLM in February 2022?
Yes.
And did you do a specialty with your LLM?
Yeah, because my work experience and background is like that of a North Korea and some national security thing. When I apply for the law school, I take the Georgetown the top priority, because the Georgetown's venue is at Washington, D.C., which is the center of the world politics and the national security issues. And Georgetown's among the six special degrees of the Georgetown Law, national security and law special degrees nationwide and maybe worldwide top tier. So I chose that special degree when I applied for the Georgetown Law, and it was good. I learned a lot.
Tell me a little bit about your experience as a student at Georgetown Law. What were some of the classes you took? What were some of the challenges and some of the interesting parts of it?
The course curriculum is very diverse, and many of my special degree classes professors are good, not only in academically, but have some active duty at the military or active duty at the DOD or DOS. So,
you mean Department of Defense and Department of State?
Yes. And okay. Many of the professors co-teaching with the current active duty judge advocate, general counsel, or some general counsel, legal counsel at the Department of State. So then maybe the first beneficial point for the students in Georgetown Law, because many adjutant professors of the Georgetown Law are current employer to the government, which located in DC. And the biggest obstacles for me is to this was my first time to study abroad and stay a long time overseas. So, but most of the classes for the special degree program is the JD course, not only for the LLM students, like the, all the other ordinary classes like the constitution or civil procedure, but the classes like the cybersecurity law and pro seminar for the national security issues and nuclear law and policy. That is all Jade listed, so I have to participate in free debate in every classes, every time with the, not only the LLM students, but also the JD people. And most of them are currently working at the military as a lawyer and some DOS or CIA. So yeah, I have some, I felt some difficulty in speaking English and debate on English because of my clumsy English. That was my biggest obstacles, but also quite meaningful challenge to me a lot.
And what's your journey been with learning English? I assume you grew up learning and speaking Korean. At what point did you start learning English? And how did you learn it?
First time when I was in middle school, as about 13 or 15 years old, I began to do a computer games, and at the time I played RPG or adventure games many American companies made. I remember the Indiana Jones or some Tentacle, the Doomsday, or Monkey Island. So I got a present of the kind of floppy disk computer games with the English manuals only, and there was no Korean translations. It takes time, but I want to play, so I have to find a dictionary by myself, and that was the biggest motivation for me to learn English. Yeah, that starts me to start English, learn English.
That's great. Pop culture is such a big motivator for language learning. I remember when I lived in Japan, there was a cartoon book, a comic book that I wanted to be able to read, and that was my biggest motivation. So, and then you, I assume you studied English in school as part of the curriculum in Korea?
Yes, it is a mandatory. The subsequent government put huge amount of time for the official syllabus of the public schools. So yeah, we Korean children have to study a lot in English in school.
Was there a point in your English study, either while you were in Korea or maybe after you came to the US, where you started to feel more fluent? Where you sort of noticed, hey, I can have a conversation in English now, and I don't need to check a dictionary every 5 seconds.
Yeah, not every 5 seconds, but sometimes every 50 seconds. Yeah, maybe some legal terminology or some national security terminology. I know a lot, even in Korea, but what makes me embarrassed is that sometimes I do not the words my kids speak in their schools or with their friends. So some very basic word, easy word, but not a slang, but a common words among children. But I encountered that word first time, so I have to check a dictionary for that reason. And before I came to States, maybe most of the Korean people like me have the same problem, that we were educated to stick to the perfect grammar to speak or write in a full phrase or sentence. So it makes us kind of delay or be obstacles to speak easily, speak frequently. But I learned in here that contents matter, not the grammar. Yes, it is important, but contents of the what you want to say is more important, and practice makes perfect, not the perfect makes practice. So I try to just spit it out of my mouth as much as I can, and it helps a lot.
That's really good advice and perspective. I know how you feel when you're in another language or another country and you want to say something right, and you start to realize, I think I just have to say this.
Yeah.
And so have your kids become multilingual now?
I think so, and I hope so. And some days ago, I was surprised that when they are sleeping, they say in English while sleeping. So I was surprised.
Oh, they're talking in their sleep in English?
Yeah. That was a big change.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. And do you anticipate your multilingualism being a benefit when you return to Korea and work with the Ministry of Unification again?
Yes, that is not indispensable or prerequisite or some critical matter to work at the ministry, but definitely beneficial to work in the ministry in any department. What I mean is when you work at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or work in the Ministry of Trade, that is very critical. But in the Ministry of Unification, we work with North Koreans, which in same Korean, but because of some sensitive or many reluctant attitude of North Koreans, many times we walk through UN or some international NGOs, not directly to the North Korea. So in that case, we have to communicate in English. And especially in some manner, in some issues, it is too sensitive to hire an interpreter. So we have to talk with the authorities in UN or some other international NGOs by ourselves, not with any other translator or interpreter. So we have to be able to communicate in English by ourselves. So in that matter, it helps a lot.
Oh, wow. I had not thought about that. And that does make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. That's a really good example. Mm-hmm. As we get towards the end of this interview, I wanted to ask you, is there any advice you have, or is there any advice that you've been given for students who come to study law in the U.S. or students who are thinking about government work, either in Korea or elsewhere?
For the English or just overall general?
Yeah, for English or in general. Work about working in law and government.
In Korea, the hiring path is very specific. So we have to pass the exam or have to take the PhD degree or master degree and apply for some special competition. So the many students or applicants already know how to get into the South Korean government and what it is like. So I'd better talk about some legal matters or legal background can help work in the government, because we all, maybe not in North Korea, but in most of the civilized country, we are living in the society or living ruling of law. So especially the government, because it, even though it is not a legislative branch, we really did a lot of legislation, the presidential decrees and interpretation of the law, and most of our policy making or policy implementing process or the actual substantial affairs of our work is binding with law. And I was quite surprised in US that the kind of rule of law and legal counsel portion and legal counsel's the work is much more expanded than that is in South Korea. So for South Korea and maybe in Japan and maybe China, the portion of the legal background people will definitely be expanded in the future. So yeah, the many diverse backgrounds, government worker or civil servant is necessary, not only the law, but even you are majoring in statistics or some international relations or some science, understanding the basic of the law and legal matters, not only the some domestic but also the international law, can be really helpful for your working in the working level.
That's really good perspective. Yes. And yes, we do have a lot of lawyers here in the U.S., especially in Washington, D.C., but there's a much wider role, I guess, that lawyers play in U.S. government and business culture than, I guess, perhaps in other countries. Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for joining me today. I wanted to ask you one last question, and that is if you have any recommendation or recommendations. Is there something you've read, a book, an article, a TV show you've watched, perhaps a restaurant you've eaten at recently, or anything else, a place you visited that you would like to recommend to others?
Not for the English study purpose, just for
Or for English study, just something, just for fun, something you've enjoyed recently.
I got a question even from the Georgetown law professors about this question, and my answer is something of related to my work about the North Korea or North Korean nuclear issues. And my recommendation is the Steel Lane, the movie, the Steel Lane is in the Netflix, and it deals with some North Korean nuclear problems. The first one is the it concludes the a discussion with some kind of dramatic ending. I cannot tell in detail because it can be a spoiler.
Okay.
And the second version of the Steel Lane is some kind of some happening and coup d'etat in North Korea, and the US president and the South Korean president and the chairman of the North Korea was prison into some nuclear submarine shell altogether, and something happened. And Steel Lane is as it is as a film movie is good, and actors are great, and it deals with some dramatic touch on the North Korean nuclear issues.
Oh, wow. I'm looking at it on Netflix website right now, Steel Rain. It looks very dramatic. And I know Korea has developed a reputation for putting out some very good movies and entertainment in general.
Yeah. And in similar context, my second recommendation is Crash Landing on You, also in Netflix. It is not a political or some military touch, but some kind of melodrama or comedy, some soap opera series of 16 episodes. And you can see what and how the North Korean ordinary people live in their villages and at home, and yeah, they have some good story and quite a suspense and yeah, love story. And the main character became a real fiance and become a bride and bridegroom.
Due to the actor.
Yeah.
The actor and the actress ended up getting married after making the movie together. Oh, wow. That's really great. Wow. So Steel Rain and Crash Landing on You. We'll put the links for both of those in the show notes. And now I want to watch these too. So thank you so much for the great recommendations. Okay. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. As I said, we'll include any relevant links from the episode in the show notes. I want to remind our listeners to subscribe to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, Himalaya, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also listen to all episodes on uslawessentials.com. If you have any questions, comments, reactions, ideas, etc., we always love hearing from our listeners. You can contact us by email at daniel@uslawessentials.com or through the U.S. Law Essentials Facebook group or LinkedIn group. And Ryan, I wish you well in your return to Korea in the new year, and I wish you a happy new year as well.
Happy New Year, all, and thank you for having me, even though my clumsy English.
I think it was fine. It was great, and it's been a real eye-opening discussion. There's so much that I did not know about, and I enjoyed hearing about, and that I think all of our listeners will appreciate as well. So, thanks for listening to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, and stay essential.
Thank you.